Maybe we should use my recording then, because you sound a little pixelated. It would be like getting off of one of the protected witness transcripts.
Oh, that's not a bad idea. Can I? Yeah, we can do video, and I can just make the room real dark and just tease my beautiful face occasionally.
It'd be like the Family Guy where they do a silhouette of Kermit the Frog and try to hide him.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
Wow, your voice just got about 3 octaves deeper. Well done. You know the recording's going, right?
Totally.
Yes, now that we know we are online, we must use our radio voices.
Yes.
Oh, I see. Well, all right, gentlemen. If you don't mind, I'll give you a quick background. I've been working in the engine and aircraft leasing business for the last 18 years, with engines being my forte. So I've worked on everything from the JT-8s, the JT-9s, the full range of CFM56s, the Pratt & Whitney 4000s, the RB211s, the PW2000s as well, as well as some of the CF engines and PW120s. So I know a little bit about engines, at least it's broad, but maybe not quite so deep. And one of the interesting things I thought with this new AD that came out on the CFM56-7Bs after the Southwest accident, which had the inlet cowl blow off the engine when the fan blade failed, was now the AD is number 2018-0951. It was emergency AD that came out after that accident.
So what is an AD?
Oh, you all right.
You know, the basics sometimes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, here I am in the midst of my jargon without actually knowing exactly what the level of expertise my audience has. So that's a good point.
So if you hold on for 1 second, for those of you listening, welcome to episode 191 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations.
I'm Foz Mamoon. We're going to make it clear what's going on here? We're going to just go straight in?
We already did.
Fair point. It was a hell of a cold open.
Yeah.
That was. I thought perhaps you guys might be editing that in there somewhere. Sorry, I thought
someone who doesn't listen to our podcast. He would know that there's not really much editing. So Seth and Foz obviously are here this week, and we've got Tom, who, as you just heard, deals with engine and aircraft leasing. And Tom is, as some of you may have, if you do listen to the podcast, you know that last week we talked a lot about engines, and we asked a whole lot of questions because we don't really know much of anything, and we decided maybe we should get someone who knows way more than all of us to talk about this stuff. And so enter Tom. As you were, please continue.
Well, all right.
So what is an AD?
An AD is an airworthiness directive. It's issued by the FAA in this case with regard to, since the CFMs and the Boeing 737 are based in the United States, then the FAA basically has jurisdiction over that type certificate and anything to do with the aircraft and the engines therein. So an airworthiness directive came out, an emergency airworthiness directive came out by order, executive order, regarding this engine type and all models of 7B engines, which there are a number of them, basically covering all the different thrust ranges, all the different upgrades that they've done. But any CFM 56-7B engine, which powers any of the 737NG family, is now falls under this AD. And it's an interesting concept in the AD because basically it only identifies engines with 30,000 or more flight cycles since new. And I assume you might know that a flight cycle is basically a takeoff and a landing. That's one cycle. So these engines that have more than 30,000 cycles now must be inspected ultrasonically, each one of their fan blades, to determine whether or not there's a potential failure.
So here's a question. I know that, you know, engines are cycled out separately from the frame and other maintenance work. Is 30,000 cycles, it seems like a lot, but is it?
It's a significant amount. Let's assume, all right. The way the life limited parts in the engine are broken down, there's basically 30,000 in the low-pressure compressor. There's 20,000 in the high-pressure compressor, 20,000 in the HPT high-pressure turbine, that is, and 25,000 in the low-pressure turbine. That's basically at least one full run of LLPs, and then at least, at a minimum, one shop visit.
And LLP so is these engines, limited lifetime parts?
Oh, life limited parts. Life limited parts. Sorry.
Okay. Correct. So that's like seals and stuff that are designed to fail over time?
Discs as well. You know, every disc, basically, anything which is exposed to high pressure or high temperature limits, they're the major rotating parts in the engine.
Gotcha.
And so they all are life limited. Once that life limit is hit, they can no longer be flown. They must be disposed of completely. They cannot be refurbished in any way. So these engines have gone through at least one shop visit. And when you're talking an operator like a Southwest, or I was discussing with Foz, actually Gol down in Brazil also flies significant amounts of these engines and this aircraft type. And for very short legs, they're actually, they have less than a 1-to-1 hour to cycle ratio, which means that each cycle across the average in the fleet is less than 1 hour. So very short hops.
Crazy. Yeah, so that means they're replacing these life-limited parts frequently, but also that they're going to hit this 30,000 cycle for the more in-depth and ultrasonic inspection more quickly?
That is exactly correct, yes. They will hit this more quickly. They will have to look at this, and we will make a determination at that time. We'll see what starts falling out. I mean, as you might have noticed, this is Southwest's second incident of this nature. The first one occurring over the Gulf of Mexico in 2016 when one of the fan blades blew out. And the damage occurred on the wing in this case. It did not enter the passenger compartment, thank goodness.
Okay, so we've got all these engines that we've got to inspect. Is it really just a matter now of going through all of them, hoping the blades are fine and if they're not, replacing them?
That is basically it, yes. But the really interesting thing I've found in this is, you know, fan blades are not tracked. Fan blades are not life-limited parts. Fan blades can be replaced at any time on the line during a normal operation. Once an aircraft lands, they inspect the engines. If they see some problems, they can call their maintenance department, have them come out and start beginning swapping fan blades. There's 24 fan blades in a CFM56-7B engine, and each one of these fan blades is weighed so that it has a matching set, basically, so that you don't throw off the balance of the engine. And when it's spinning, obviously, at high RPMs, you have to have that balance pretty well correct. So you see damage on a fan blade, you must take that fan blade off, let's say, and its twin, the one that's matching it on the other side. So you could have fan blades that are brand new, like 1,000 cycles since new, in an engine which has 30,000 cycles since new. There's no way to determine exactly how old the fan blades are because no one tracks that. It's never been something which was required before, and it's not required now.
I guess the theory, though, is that the fan blades will never be older than the engine that they're in.
Well, that's an interesting theory, but I think it doesn't work that way, I've found.
Really? So you could have blades that were taken out of one engine and then swapped to another one that was newer?
Absolutely, you could. You could have an older engine, and it goes into the shop. It's pre this AD that comes out, and you send some of the blades work, some of the blades had damage, which requires it going to an overhaul facility. Now, the overhaul facility never had to do an ultrasonic inspection before, so the fan blade is a big question mark. The fan blade could have 35, 40,000 cycles on it. You don't know. And then it's put into an engine which has 2,000 cycles since new, just because that engine had a couple of fan blades fail. So, boom, there you are, a relatively brand new engine with relatively ancient fan blades, which won't be inspected now for another 28,000 cycles.
Well, that's crazy.
A little unnerving, to say the least.
That's one of the things that I've looked at, and just it's got me shaking my head. Interestingly enough, fan blades, not life-limited parts in the CFM56 series, but in the Rolls-Royce engines, they absolutely are life-limited parts and must be tracked and have a finite life before they must be discarded.
Now, why would that be?
Rolls testing has determined that that these are more likely to fail after X number of cycles, and therefore, and depending on the environment that they're operating within.
Okay. So it's really up to the manufacturer to determine if they are LLPs or not.
Right. I mean, you know, CFM is a joint venture between Safran and GE, mm-hmm. and they both have, you know, definitive interest in keeping these engines flying as often and as much as possible. And they and all their testing have determined that this was not an issue. But, you know, they may be slightly incorrect in that case.
I'm still working on that. You can have blades that are older than the engine that they're in. I believe you. The way you explained it is perfect and it makes a ton of sense. But I'm still processing that. That's kind of crazy to me.
Well, yeah, Foz and I had this very same discussion. I think that's why he decided to drag me in on this. But
sure makes me question my decision to fly in 737s anytime soon.
Oh, still one of the safest aircraft out there. Oh, come on, it's certainly better than anything that Airbus has put out.
Well, it's an interesting thing you say that. I just read an article that Airbus is the number of planes stacking up in Hamburg and Toulouse without engines is growing at a very high rate because they are having engine issues from both Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce. and they're actually on the verge of having. I think they're going to need to take a loss either this quarter or next quarter because they can't deliver planes.
No. Yeah, I was actually in the Finck Inverter factory in Hamburg mid-April, like 3 weeks ago maybe, with Jason, who's been a guest on the show a few times, and we were walking around, and there's always been a bunch of gliders, they call them, you know, aircraft without engines, sitting around at the Toulouse and Finck Inverter sites, and there were more and more and more. And one of the interesting things was when you go in through the tour, they take you through a final assembly line for the 320 family, so you see them all being put together, and then you go into the 380 line, and the 380 line in Hamburg is basically they assemble the one of the forward fuselage sections with sort of without the flight deck, but that whole chunk of it, and then they ship that down to Toulouse where final assembly happens, and it comes back to Hamburg for interiors and painting. And where they make those forward sections, because they've ramped down production of the 380 so much, they basically borrowed space in that hangar for other work. And the last time I did the tour, which I guess was with you a couple of years ago, Foz, right? We did that?
It was last January.
It was last January, so January 2017. If I remember correctly, they had 350s lined up because they were racing to get 350 deliveries yep. up to speed in that 380 factory or in the 380 hangar. This year, it's all extra 320s in the 380 hangar because they need more space and they need to increase pace of 320 production work. But they still, they're all gliders. And so they're doing random sort of one-off 320 work in that space. So they're stacking up extra 320s. And they literally are, you know, it's sort of like the old 787s where they were manufacturing them in Everett and they were just lined up all over Payne Field and had nowhere to stack them anymore.
Right.
They had to start closing taxiways and runways to put them in place. It feels a little bit like they're doing the same thing now with the 321s or 320 families and trying to get that stuff all lined up. And even, you know, Hawaiian has had their deliveries delayed. It's, you know, everybody's had deliveries delayed.
Yeah, the article I was reading was just immense how much profit Boeing has made over the last few years that if this problem happened to Boeing, they'd have such a larger cushion versus Airbus because Airbus has been selling more lean, for lack of a better term, for less of a profit margin. So now they have less wiggle room because of all the problems.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Well,
I'll see if I
can. On the plus side, at least we know all the fan blades on those engines are new when they were delivered.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, the GTF. I can't wait to see what kind of wear those fan blades get.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of questions about those engines. I guess one of the questions we asked last week, and none of us clearly were qualified to answer it, but Tom, maybe you have some ideas on this, is as these new sort of higher-powered engines come along, are we pressing the limits of, like, the materials? Are we pressing the limits of the engineering available to us where we're actually creating sort of increased and potentially unnecessary risk just to get, you know, to claim better fuel efficiency or whatever, you know, quieter engines and all those things? Or is this sort of just typical evolution?
I believe it's somewhat typical evolution. I mean, the GTF was certainly a leap forward. If it if they're ever able to get it to work, it'll certainly be worthwhile. I mean, I saw some of the fuel flow. They were talking about 16% savings in fuel consumption, which is really significant. That's why so many people jumped on board. If they can limit their exposure with regard to fuel and the hedging involved in the fuel, then the whole question marks with regard to fuel cost in the future, that really does help them out significantly in their quest for profitability. But, you know, every engine has had teething problems, any one that's certainly been a great leap forward like that. But, there are also different things with regard to NOx emissions, all the different emissions, and the noise as well, with various government bodies forcing this down the throat of the manufacturers. It's a difficult area that they're treading into when regulatory bodies try to come and tell them exactly how much noise their engines can release and how many emissions they can release, when the engine manufacturers, frankly, just want to build engines which they can sell. It, everything else is just gravy.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult for them. But, I mean, to me, quite frankly, there's no excuse for Pratt & Whitney not testing the GTF to the point where this rotor bow issues and the other issues that they're identifying now, they should certainly have been recognized somewhere previously.
So can you dig into some of the problems we're seeing with that?
Oh, we don't have any in our fleet, and thank God for that. But the rotor bow is the most interesting one, and, you know, we can certainly pick this up on another episode if you'd like me to speak again. But what it is basically is, I guess, dissimilar metals in the rotor shaft, which goes back into the engine, and they heat up and cool down at different rates. So when you're trying to turn an aircraft quickly, it flies into an airport somewhere, and it's a hot day, and so this thing cools down relatively slowly, and you've got dissimilar metals cooling at different rates, which causes the rotor shaft to bow, to actually begin to deform. And then when you try to start that engine again, it's no longer spinning the way it should on these bearings.
Yeah, it's off balance.
It's off balance, exactly. So therefore, they have to – I saw start times somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 7 minutes to start an engine. Remember, you know, when you're in an aircraft and it pushes back and you hear the engine start to spool up. And you're, what is that, 30 seconds, a minute maybe?
Yeah.
Yeah, and even the early NEO deliveries, one of the reasons Qatar Airways cited as not willing to take deliveries was related to startups and high heat, you know, operations, because Doha is very hot. But that even then it was like, you know, 90 to 120 seconds just for a standard startup. And now you're saying they're having to run even slower to try to get the metals to get back to the right shape.
To get back to the right temperature so they can then begin, yeah, then they can start it up again. So, and burning up the starters as well. The starters are not built to maintain the airflow for that long. So it's kind of a domino effect. You know, that affects this, which affects this. And, you know, people quite rightly are refusing delivery of some of these, or at least waiting for Pratt & Whitney to figure out exactly what is going on. And Pratt keeps saying that we've got it fixed, that we're going to be putting engines out there and everything's going to be fine very soon. In fact, I think their new CEO was saying how they're going to be so transparent and everyone will know what's going on. And yet it has been just a nightmare for any operator who's chosen that engine type.
And the Leaps aren't, which is the new CFM product. It's essentially the air version of the new Pratt & Whitney engine, which is, it's on the 737 MAX, if I remember correctly.
Yes, Leap is on a few different engines, aircraft type.
Aircraft, but yeah. That has also had its share of teething problems and getting things done right and delivery delays and such, right?
It has, but I don't believe anywhere near as well publicized as the Pratt, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's just one of these situations where, you know, it's a little bit of damned if you do, damned if you don't, as an airline or an aircraft manufacturer, or as an airline choosing which engine you're going to use. I mean, there's slightly less screwed or totally screwed, but no one seems to be completely in the clear.
No, that's right. I do believe that from what I understand in the market, I mean, my company as a leasing company has done incredibly well with our A320 CEOs, the current engines, mm-hmm. as opposed to the NEOs, because these GTF operators cannot take delivery in time, and they have demand that they cannot meet. So
you're doing like short-term, medium-term placement of aircraft while they're as stopgap for these companies?
Yeah, 18 to 36-month leases while they wait to see exactly what is going to happen.
Yeah. Well, Leap says they're 4 to 5 weeks behind schedule back in January, so I'm sure there's, you know, things are hopefully getting better, but they are indeed having some delays as well.
I see. All right, excellent. And the Leap engine, I was just checking it. It powers the NEO, the MAX, and the COMAC C919.
Okay. Well, you know, COMAC isn't delivering too many yet, so I guess that's good news.
That is correct. They are not.
I think that's okay.
That will be also an interesting thing for you to discuss on your show here.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back to China and track down another random airplane, huh?
Just because
I chased down the ARJ. I got that flight, so it was an experience.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, excellent. At least you weren't on the Sukhoi when they did that flight in China, yes?
I thought it was the one that crashed was Malaysia, I thought.
Oh, was it? I knew it was somewhere in Asia. I thought it was China for some reason.
Well, certainly very good I wasn't on that since everybody died. Yeah,
Indonesia, exactly.
Indonesia. Okay, yeah. They turned off one of the warning systems in the flight deck because it was too loud while they were giving tours to dignitaries or something like that. And then, oops, they crashed into a hill. So.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, that was pretty bad.
I missed that.
I'd rather wait for proven technology, if at all possible.
Yeah, well, you know, Sukhoi, speaking of, we're going to have the smaller SSJ. They want to build a 75-seater now, down from the 100-seater, because apparently the 70-seat market just isn't competitive enough between Bombardier and Embraer.
Now that they both have some deep-pocketed supporters,
exactly.
It's interesting to see what happens if Sukhoi actually thinks they can make a difference in that market space.
Well, I'm really intrigued by it just because Sukhoi, with the COMAC partnership in China, I mean, if you give them a 70-seater, the ARJ, which is sort of a 100-ish seater, you've got the 919, which is their 737 or A320 equivalent, and then I guess it's the 929 is the next one, which is the twin aisle that they're working on. It's, you know, none of them are spectacular aircraft necessarily, but very quickly, you've got a company or a joint venture between China and Russia that has essentially a full suite of commercial aircraft, similar to what you could get from an Airbus or Boeing. Obviously not the full range, but it's pretty close. It becomes an interesting, and both of them are government supported, right? UAC, which owns Sukhoi, is Russian government supported in many ways. Maybe not as explicitly as the Chinese companies are, but it clearly is. And COMAC, everything in China is government supported essentially. So funding isn't as much of a challenge necessarily. And those two countries decide that they want to compete. And especially in China, where they do a great job of stealing intellectual property, and Boeing and Airbus have both put final assembly lines in the country. Like, hey, look at that. All of a sudden, these guys actually know how to build planes, have designs to build planes, and are kind of actually doing it. They get the funding. It's an interesting third player in the market.
So that certainly is. Yeah.
You ready to fly on that thing?
Yeah, see, that, having spent time in Russia, having spent time in Russian MROs, which are maintenance, repair, and overhaul organizations, I'll stick with a Western aircraft for now, if at all possible.
Yeah. The good news, for better or worse, is that they are using mostly Western avionics. So at least the flight deck knows that there's a problem. It's a matter of can the rest of the aircraft respond to it, I guess, is what we're coming to.
Exactly. Yeah. They'll certainly be able to see very well what they're about to hit.
Yeah.
I believe, you know, the future's bright for these companies, as you've stated, and they do have deep pockets supporting them. Well, with Russia in mind, as long as gas prices stay high, we'll see what happens with government support as if the long-term trend on fuel prices is continuing to decline.
Yeah. Well, I'm depending on who you ask, the U.S. airline CEOs this past quarter, you know, just did all their earnings reports and calls, and none of them seem to be predicting fuel price drops anytime soon. I think Doug Parker over at American Airlines says $70 a barrel is the new normal, so get used to it. So we'll see how well that holds.
And it went tumbling stocks the same day.
Yeah, he was, well, not surprisingly. I mean, yeah. When you get him promising you that $5 billion a year profit is about the right number, and yet he can't deliver it on any regular basis, and then explains that this is what the cost base is going to be going forward, it makes sense that the pricing of the stocks doesn't line up with what they're actually delivering.
It's okay, they'll make it up in volume.
Yeah.
Isn't he the one that also said that he couldn't foresee them returning to unprofitability ever anytime soon?
Yes.
Sounds like a genius thing to say, especially to investors.
Yeah, he treats those calls with disdain. Like, literally, if you hear his voice, you know, they have the prepared remarks and they answer the questions. And just the tone of his voice reading the prepared remarks is a whole lot of, I can't believe they're making me do this shit again this quarter.
Nice. He speaks to everybody with disdain. Customers, yeah. Investors, it doesn't matter.
That's a fair point. But I just feel like these investor calls, like, he's like heavy sighs and like, just so disappointed that he has to do it. It's kind of amazing.
Well, you know, if it's so important, he could just go private and then not have to report anything.
That's true. I think he probably doesn't quite have the cash for that. But they are, you know, buying back stock a couple billion dollars at a time. So anyway. Well, I think that probably wraps up the conversation with Tom. Thank you very, very much for actually explaining all the stuff that we asked all the questions about last week and had no clue on. Really appreciate that.
This was definitely good. We'll have to do it again.
All right, gentlemen. Yes, especially after you're talking about the A380, I would love to tell you the thoughts that we have in the leasing business about why the A380 is such a horrible aircraft to purchase from a financier's point of view.
It's the same reason that you don't see many 72 Cadillac sedan DeVilles on the road.
Well, it's all about the secondary markets, and you know, I think I'd be happy to have one of those, actually, so I don't know.
Well, happy to have an A380 or a 72 Cadillac?
72 Caddy, yeah. Especially if it had, what, the 500 cubic inch engine that they did, right?
With those deep bucket leather seats.
Hey, you know what? You would be styling in that, Foz. I could just see this.
If I could actually navigate that anywhere and find one good condition, I would love one. But, you know, with fuel prices going, I'm not sure what's cheaper, fueling that or a 737.
Depends on the model.
All right. Well, we will definitely love, I think, a conversation about the A380 in the secondary market would be really interesting. So we'll definitely have to pick that back up at another time. But thank you very much for joining us. And we'll catch up again soon.
Well, thank you, Sean. I'm sorry. Thank you, Seth and Foz. I appreciate all your time, and you guys take care.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye. Alrighty, so that was kind of spooky, but really interesting stuff talking to Tom there. Hope our listeners enjoyed that. Foz, a couple other topics that I want, you know, I think we all wanted, or we talked about earlier in the week about getting to. One, I would like to apologize to all of our listeners who live south of the equator. We have been talking about the antipodes on a number of episodes recently. I know when we had Cynthia on as a guest, we used that word a lot. And it's apparently antipodes. And we've been saying it wrong. And so you're still south of the equator. Your toilet's still flush backwards. But the least we can do is pronounce the antipodes correctly. So sorry about
that. Is there an entity like QR that came out to tell you how to properly pronounce this?
I may have received a message from one of our listeners.
Okay.
Otherwise, how the hell would I have known?
You probably heard.
I was one of the same antipodes.
You heard the word somewhere. And go, what word is that?
Yeah, the what's with the who? Huh? Anyway, so getting beyond that, other news this week. Boeing had its earnings call last week. It's, you know, that time of year for the airline and aviation industry. And one of the things that they indicated was that the 777s that Iran Air had ordered are now officially deferred for at least a year. So this is one of those things that since the moment the order was announced, there had been a ton of questions about will they ever actually happen due to regulatory concerns, due to, you know, Congress not necessarily wanting to let them be exported. With the deal was signed under the Obama administration. The Trump administration has been far more anti-Iran since then. There's been a lot of questions, and the answer seems to be, at least for now, still not happening. So that's interesting news, let's say. Someone posted a thing today suggesting that Iran Air couldn't find financing for it.
I wouldn't be surprised about that. Who was the airline that was to Kenya that promised all sorts of things and then couldn't get aircraft leased?
Probably.
Maybe they can.
I know they've had a terrible time financially, and they've, you know, sort of restructured a couple times recently. So it would not surprise me if they're in that trouble zone.
Maybe they can start a consortium.
Yeah. It's one of the things, and I think we talked about the American Airlines 787 order, but one of the things we did not mention at that time is Boeing is going to finance the 787-8s, the smaller ones.
Oh, I did not know that.
And, you know, going back to the discussion that I think we had about how this is going to potentially erode the NMA market and, you know, how it's backfilling the 767s and proving that, you know, getting the 787 deferred costs down because Boeing can basically sell them so ridiculously cheap now, and airlines can afford to buy them at the cheaper price and not worry about the fact that it's designed to go, you know, 7,000 miles instead of 5,000 or whatever, you know, their needs really are, that the 76 used to do. It's an interesting sort of setup in terms of if Boeing's able to finance them, and Boeing clearly has the cash they're sitting on to do that, it really, really changes the economics of that operation.
You know, there's one part of the economics we haven't really talked about on the 7.8 versus the 7.6, which is the 7.6s were built in Everett exclusively. The 7.8s are done in Everett and South Carolina. As South Carolina is a right-to-work state, they have much more flexibility.
Union-free.
So I wonder if there's a cost advantage from a production standpoint that they see by doing 7.8s, because they can build more in South Carolina, and that's clearly where they're growing the plant more so than Everett.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And, you know, I know they're doing the Dash 10s exclusively in South Carolina, and they said that's a function of the size of the aircraft versus the factory floor. But there's all sorts of second-guessing that statement in the market.
Right.
You know, if they needed to, they could probably make it work somehow. But, yeah, that's an interesting point of, you know, further adjusting the cost basis if they choose to expand production or ramp up production more on the East Coast than the West Coast. That's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's just something that occurred to me that, you know, they clearly have a higher cost to produce in Everett. That might play into it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just talking about ramping up production as a general thing, both Boeing and Airbus are also still talking about further increasing their production monthly rates for the single aisles, the 320s and the 737 families. And their suppliers are starting to balk at that, basically saying, listen, guys, we're giving you as many components as we possibly can. We get that you can assemble them faster, but a few suppliers, and particularly the engine manufacturers, but also a bunch of the other ones, are starting to balk at further production rate increases. So we seem to be hitting a lot of limits right now in the industry, and it'll be interesting to see what the next step is to break through that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, you know, we're talking about all this on the Boeing side of ramping up production and what have you. But Airbus this week announced they're cutting down production of the 330.
Yeah, what's the time frame on that?
So the in 20, in last year in 2017 they made 67. In 2018 they will do 60, and next year they will do 50.
Okay. So. And you know, the interesting thing there is they definitely have reasons to, you know, they've been having challenges on the 330 Neo order book, and I know these are mostly CEOs that we're talking about right now, but the American deal cut a bunch of potentially 330 Neos or 350s from the order book. Hawaiian dropped a handful, a couple dozen, yep, switching to 787s. AirAsia keeps threatening to do things, but we'll probably, or AirAsia X, I should say, but keeps threatening to do things about the Twin Aisles, but we'll probably stick with the Airbus. So it is an interesting situation. And Airbus, for its part, keeps saying, oh no, the Dash 8's really going to be a big seller. We're ready to go. The Dash 800, which is their smaller Neo, it's the equivalent of the A330-200, but with new engines. And it has zero orders right now. And it's in certification work. They're flying it around and testing to get it ready. But the 900, which is the bigger one, is going to get delivered later this year. It's painted in TAP livery, and it's going to happen. But the build count and the order backlog is not spectacularly strong. And it's, I've said this on many episodes, I think, and I will say it again. I think they missed the boat when they put the design spec together. I think it's too much airplane for a bunch of airlines that didn't need that much.
And I think it's just late to market for what it is.
That could be also. Yeah. I mean, the 787 had, at this point, almost a decade head start.
I mean, in many ways, it's just like the 764.
Yeah. Late to the game. Is it one of those things that it's late to the game eventually people realize, oh, we kind of did want that, but now it's too late? Or you think, if they really can maintain 50 a year, that's a sufficient output rate that they could sort of ramp back up pretty easily as opposed to dropping to like 10 or 20.
I mean, the problem is, right, I think it's a twofold problem is there are probably airlines that would find it attractive, but they would also need to be current Airbus operators. I don't think anyone's going to add that as a new fleet type just for some of the benefits they get from it. And I think that might be part of what the American decision was, because they only have a handful of 330s versus 78s, where they could just continue to grow the 78 pool, and just they're already committed to decommissioning a bunch of the 330s, the 333s in the next year and a half. And I think we'll just see a sunset of the 332s much faster because it can help them simplify their fleet management.
Well, they're delaying some of the retirements until these 78s start to show up. So it is, yes, I think I agree with you that the fleet simplification makes sense, but it's not a perfect solution. Or it's not a perfect timing situation for American. They'd have to shift some things around.
Yeah, but it gives them the ability to, in the longer term, because they have a huge array of fleets and sub-fleets, so it helps them minimize some of that and standardize on an airplane.
Yeah, which is good news. One last ridiculous story. How do you dispatch an airplane for a transatlantic flight and forget that you didn't load catering?
This just amazes me.
So the story here is that British Airways had a Dallas to Heathrow flight a couple weeks ago now that they didn't cater in Dallas. And they took off and someone realized, there's a spectacular oh shit moment. And they diverted to JFK to pick up catering and then finished the flight from there. So, good news. Someone was able to make a phone call to JFK, and in the 3 hours that it took them to fly there, they were able to get some food, cooked, because catering usually takes some time to produce these things. So, good relationship with your catering option in JFK. British Airways has so many flights there a day. It makes sense that they didn't have the relationships to do it. But also, what carts were on board? Was it just all the trash from the last flight?
Well, the other thing is, if they never deboarded the old carts, the question then becomes, do they have a customs problem with all the alcohol, right? That is all supposed to get trashed.
Right. And just the trash is supposed to be trash.
Right.
And I guess, if you take it off at JFK, it's still, you give it to the bonded, whatever, trash people, and it's considered that it goes to the incinerator and whatnot. But, did no one notice during pre-departure beverages and business class that they were pouring old champagne? The number of different places this... Did none of the flight attendants during the boarding process look in the carts and be like, huh, all these glasses are dirty?
Well, how did they not do their prep work, right? Any airline, any flight I've been on, the crew is always checking that they have all the things they need for their flight before they pull from the gate.
Yeah, I mean, maybe the drinks cart was loaded but not the food cart. I don't know. It just, the whole thing seems crazy to me. And yet here it is, it happened.
I'm just amazed.
Hooray, airlines. Anyhow. Alrighty, you got any fun trips coming up?
I'm just doing a quick turn to Copenhagen this week, and actually we'll see Steven before I leave in Vegas.
Nice. So, another Copenhagen trip? They're still selling those tickets too cheap for you?
It's like the problem ones. Once you're in the hamster wheel, how do you get off?
Jump.
Yeah, well, I could, but...
Just as suggestions go, it seems to have mostly worked for me.
Yeah, I'm working on that. I'm working on that.
Yeah,
I'm not doing one a month now, so, you know, I'm weaning myself off.
Okay, like every 6 weeks now?
No, I probably haven't done this in 2 months.
All right, good. Excellent, wow.
Cool.
Nice. All righty, well, enjoy that trip, and to all of our listeners, thanks for joining. I was going to say sorry for the chaos, but we kind of enjoy it, so hope you do too. If you're still listening, you probably do. You can find us at DotsLines on Twitter, moredotsmorelines.com. Check out the Patreon account if you like early access to the episodes. We've been publishing them there 2 to 3 days earlier on average, so that's kind of cool. And other than that, have a great trip. Take care.
Take care, guys.